third case of the morning, which is United States versus Dexter Anderson and Valencia Parsons. As soon as things get settled, we'll start with that. All set?
Yes.
Got to note that Ms. Carletti is arguing first. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Amy Carletti, and I represent one of the appellants in this case, Valencia Parsons. Unless there are any questions from the Court, I'm going to start off with the Sixth Amendment violation that occurred in this case. This was a case about two individuals, nicknamed Dex and Ebony, selling drugs in Green Bay. And throughout this trial, the government's purpose was to link Dexter Anderson and Valencia Parsons to those two nicknames. The way they did that was through the hearsay testimony of their key witness, DEA agent Bernard Bolf. Now, the government admits that Agent Bolf testified to the hearsay conversations of confidential informant 598. 598 never testified at trial, and his identity was never revealed at trial, which is a clear violation of Valencia Parsons' Sixth Amendment rights. Now, the issue here is, how significant was this error? How important was this error to this case? And the way you can see how important this error was to this case is to look at the government's conduct from day one on trial. Agent Bolf's testimony tried to link Parsons and Anderson to these two nicknames. It started with Bolf the very first day as the very first witness. Bolf's intent on the stand was to lay out this link. What he did was establish the very heart of the government's case by testifying to what CI 598 said, and then testify to the hearsay conversations he had with other confidential informants throughout his investigation that linked those two nicknames to Anderson and Parsons. In doing so, Detective Bolf testified about the conversation he had with a confidential informant while investigating another confidential informant named Mendel Campbell. This confidential informant, as Detective Bolf told the jury, stated that Ebony, the nickname that CI 598 told Bolf about, was actually Valencia Parsons. And throughout this trial, the government, when questioning other confidential informants on the stand, referred to the two defendants as Dex and Ebony. That's how important CI 598's testimony was to this case. And that's how important the Sixth Amendment violation was.
Was there any objection to this testimony?
There was not, Your Honor, and that's why we're here under the plain error standard. Now, the other significance of Bolf's testimony is how he used other hearsay testimony to link 598 statements to the defendants. In doing so, he tried to bolster the credibility of other confidential informants who would testify later at trial and bolster their credibility by trying to show that these two nicknames were linked to Anderson and Parsons. That was the government's point this entire case. Now, all of this indicates how important and critical this evidence was. And as the courts in Crawford, Silva, and Cromer state, they affirm the importance of the Sixth Amendment right to confrontation. Without that ability, Valencia Parsons never had the opportunity to confront witnesses brought against her. In addition to the Sixth Amendment violation, there were a number of other errors that occurred at trial.
Before you leave that subject, didn't the transactional witnesses, the other drug dealers and drug users who were called to testify independently testify to these nicknames and their attachment to the defendants?
They did, but these witnesses were completely impeachable witnesses. They were admitted drug users and sellers, and they were confronted with that during cross-examination, and that's why the government presented Agent Bolf's testimony first. And that's why the government presented Agent Bolf's testimony stating that these confidential informants throughout his investigation told Agent Bolf that Dex and Ebony were actually Anderson and Parsons. So in doing so, although these witnesses testified to that, the only way that they were believable is because Agent Wolf had taken the stand first and said, I believe them too, and so should you. And that's shown by the government's statements on closing argument. In closing argument, when talking about the statements of these confidential informants, their names are Renee Rogers, Mendel Campbell, and Alexander Richard. The government said informants tell the truth, and when the truth is corroborated by a police investigation, they're believable. So here, this entire case was based off of these two nicknames established by CI 598, who never testified at trial. And all the other evidence that came in, including these confidential informants, was trying to link Anderson and Parson to those two names. Now, in addition to this error, like I said, there were other errors that occurred at trial. They've all been briefed, but I'd like to focus the court on the issue of severance, and specifically why severance was necessary in this case. And it was for two reasons. One, because when Dexter Anderson took the stand, he directly implicated Valencia Parsons, bringing a second theory of prosecution into this case. And in addition to that, earlier trial testimony regarding the admitted drug users and sellers' activities with Anderson unduly prejudiced Parsons in this case. When Dexter Anderson took the stand, he directly implicated Valencia Parsons by saying she was involved with Derek Mitchell. Now, Derek Mitchell is another nickname of one of the drug dealers that CI 598 told Agent Wolf about, and that the government alleged was actually Dexter Anderson. When Anderson got on the stand, he said that Valencia Parsons was involved in Derek Mitchell, and in doing so created two theories of prosecution. The government, in its indictment, alleged that Valencia Parsons conspired with Dexter Anderson. And Dexter Anderson, in his testimony, stated that Valencia Parsons conspired with Derek Mitchell. In addition to that, and all the other errors at trial, Valencia Parsons was deprived of her due process right to a fair trial and deserves a new one. I see that I'm running out of time, so unless there are other questions, hand it to Mr. Casey.
Okay. Mr. Casey?
Your Honors, Anthony Casey on behalf of Dexter Anderson. In this case, the error I'd like to focus on is that during closing arguments, the government distorted the burden of proof as to substance identity by instructing the jury that they did not have to find that the substance in question was crack cocaine, when in fact they did. In deciding
also, the case law, this distinction between crack cocaine and cocaine base involves sentencing. Isn't that correct?
Yes, sir.
Chemically, they're the same, but the form of crack is a little. Well, it's characteristic of crack, not necessarily of cocaine base in general.
Right, I think...
Isn't crack cocaine sort of a subgroup of cocaine base?
It is, Your Honor. Crack cocaine is one type of cocaine base, but there are other types, and under the Edwards opinion, I think it starts out with saying, you know, all crack cocaine is cocaine base, but not all cocaine base is crack. And that's the issue here, that under the statute... And under the way the jury, you know, the trial was set up that the jury was supposed to decide whether or not the defendants were involved in crimes involving crack cocaine, and then the government got up and instructed them, but you don't have to decide that, it's already been taken care of. And by doing that, they completely eliminated their burden of proof on that question. And you know, this brings the case into the bargain.
But the defense here wasn't that this was cocaine based, not crack cocaine. The defense was that we aren't the same people that you're talking about.
Well, you know, that was
mistaken identity or something.
That was the primary focus of the trial. Two responses to that. First, that I don't think that is decisive here because the defendants didn't have to put on the defense. The government had to prove that the substance was crack. And contrary to the government's assertion in the brief, there was some evidence put into the record that the substance was not crack cocaine, specifically when the defense cross-examined Agent Bolf as to whether there were apparatus for cooking cocaine into crack found in the house. The government claims that this is consistent with the identity defense, but I don't see how that's possible. The only relevance of whether Dexter Anderson in his house had apparatus for cooking cocaine into crack cocaine would be to show that the substance found in the house was not, in fact, crack cocaine. It was cocaine, another form of cocaine base. So at least in part there was some evidence put in to that defense, but that's kind of, it still wasn't the burden of the defendant to come and show that it wasn't crack cocaine. It was the burden of the government to show that it was crack cocaine.
You're here on plain error review on this issue, is that right?
Yes, we are.
Okay.
And because of that, we have to show, as I think we have in our briefs, that the jury would have come out a different way had this error not been committed. And here, the jury never got a chance to consider the question of crack cocaine. And if we look at the record, there is not enough evidence for them to have, if they had considered the question, found that it was crack cocaine.
How is it that you're arguing the jury didn't have a chance to consider this? Was there an instructional error committed?
Well, the error was in the prosecution's statement to the jury when they said to them, two comments particularly. One, you know, we've stipulated it's crack cocaine. More importantly, they also said another time, you have to find that this is cocaine based. So both of those tell the jury that don't worry about this question. It's not for you to consider.
What did the judge tell the jury?
The judge gave instructions prior to this saying that they had to find, at some points the judge said you had to find that it was cocaine based in the form of crack cocaine. At other times the judge interchanged the terms, and at one point he said you have to find that the substance was cocaine based. Now that was inaccurate, and the argument is that because of that inaccuracy, those instructions could not have ameliorated the error created by the prosecution's statements that the jury didn't need to worry about it.
But elsewhere in the instructions, the judge did tell the jury it had to find the substance at issue was crack cocaine?
It did.
Okay.
But then the prosecution said, you have to find this, but it's already been stipulated to, don't worry about it.
Right.
Which means that the jury would have gone back and seen, that's already been established. Granted, it's a requirement in this charge, but it's been established, so they didn't consider it.
Well, did the court instruct the jury as to the stipulation?
Not in the improper manner, no, they did not.
How did the stipulation come into evidence?
The stipulation was read into evidence during the trial.
Okay. So to the extent that there was a conflict between the prosecutor's closing argument and the actual stipulation that was read to the jury is always told that the arguments are not evidence, they're to focus on the evidence, not the argument?
Yes, Your Honor. However, in this case, and I think the case law on this established, this issue, given that the judge is referring to cocaine base and then crack cocaine, the prosecutor is referring to cocaine base and then crack cocaine, you read a stipulation that says someone's going to testify that the substance is cocaine base, then the prosecutor says, don't worry about this, we've stipulated it's crack cocaine, all you have to decide is it's cocaine base. It's kind of hard to imagine that the jury would have said, oh, we know the distinction, we don't need anyone to explain it to us. I mean, it seems like everyone in trial was confused about what the difference between crack cocaine and cocaine, the terms, was.
What other evidence was there in the record, apart from the stipulation, about the nature of the controlled substance in question?
I think the government points to two main areas, and I think both of them are insufficient. First, they point to Agent Ball's testimony, and Agent Ball's testimony throughout suffers from the same confusion. At one point, he's talking about what an 8-ball is, and he's talking about cocaine. It's not clear whether he's talking about an 8-ball of crack cocaine or cocaine. At another point, he's talking about a test that determines that the substance was crack cocaine. Either he didn't know the difference, or he wasn't specific enough for the jury to have based any decision on that. And the other area is the informants, who, as Ms. Carley explained, had reliability problems that the government only got around through bolstering hearsay testimony at the beginning. And on top of it, none of those informants smoked the substance in question. Only one of them had any contact with any of the substances seized. Most of them were testing out prior transactions, which there was no evidence other than their own testimony that those transactions occurred. So, you know, if you look at Dominguez, where the court has a negotiated cocaine sale and an agent saying it's cocaine, and they said that's not enough to establish that the substance was cocaine because there was evidence that the agent there was unsure, just as there's evidence here that the agent is unsure, and it distinguishes cases where the informants actually smoked or used the substance in question.
Well, the transactional witnesses, though, testified that what they were doing is either buying crack from the defendants or selling it for the defendants.
Right.
And they use that.
But based on solely that evidence, solely that testimony about prior transactions, and coming from impeachable witnesses where the government is, this brings us back to the hearsay argument, trying to get around the credibility, you can't rely on the jury to simply decide based on that.
Well, in drug cases, transactional witnesses usually are somewhat compromised with credibility problems, and we don't say that the jury is not entitled to rely on their testimony.
That's true, Your Honor, but in this case you're asking to, given that the jury never had the issue, to just assume that based on that testimony the jury would have decided that it was crack cocaine. They never were given that chance. They were instructed to not worry about it, and so that's the only thing you're pointing to when the record is full. You know, there's no evidence that it was ever smoked. There's no evidence that it was a smokable substance. There's no evidence that there was cooking apparatus in the house. To just, based on that, say, oh, the jury didn't need to worry about it, and that's what the government did, is going one step too far in saying you can rely on these witnesses.
Thank you. Mr. Roach.
Please, the court. My name is Bill Roach. I'm an attorney out of the Eastern District of Wisconsin. I was trial counsel in this case. I'm intimately familiar with this case. Let me begin my comments today by making a couple of points clear that I don't think are so clear on the record right now. First and foremost, in analyzing the issues that the defendants have raised in this case, underlying all of them, whether you consider plain error, allegations of prosecutorial misconduct, cumulative error, this court's required to look at the strength of the government's case, what kind of case we put on, and whether the issues in play were truly issues. And I'm here to tell the court, if you review this record here, you will come to the conclusion that we had a very, very good case. If you don't believe me, look at Judge Griesbach's sentencing comments in Dexter Anderson's case. On two separate occasions, he referred to the government's overwhelming evidence of guilt that they established at trial. Apart from allegations of CI 598, apart from allegations of misstatements of a stipulation involving the type of substance. So let me just spend a few minutes telling you about our case. This was a case where we did, as was brought out during the appellant's arguments, put on testimony from five informants. Five informants, each and every one of whom pointed the finger at Dexter Anderson and Valencia Parsons as the two individuals responsible for deliveries of crack cocaine in Green Bay. Five informants.
They were all witnesses?
They were all witnesses. Renee Rogers, the first witness, who later was involved in control buys. Mendel Campbell, an associate of Dexter Anderson, intimately familiar with the operation Dexter Anderson had set up, testified that I was selling crack cocaine for Dexter Anderson. In addition, Alexander Richards, another witness that bought on daily occasions from Dexter Anderson and Valencia Parsons, amounts of crack cocaine. Lakina Campbell, I believe was her name, Mendel Campbell's wife, testified, yeah, I saw Mendel Campbell and Dexter Anderson together and Valencia Parsons. And lastly, a woman by the name of Lisa Larson. I bought crack cocaine from that man there, Dexter Anderson and Valencia Parsons, and it's crack cocaine because I ingested it.
Okay, so those witnesses did make in-court IDs of each of the defendants and refer to them by their nicknames.
Absolutely. Absolutely, no doubt about it. And to put to rest any doubt whatsoever that we're talking about crack cocaine, Renee Rogers, first informant witness, testified that she'd been buying crack cocaine from Dexter Anderson for several years, sometimes a daily basis.
Well, that was a plenty of both testimony, which was pretty obviously hearsay. What?
Well, Detective Bolt was the first witness, and he was my foundational witness for the transcripts, the recorded conversations that we made of Dexter Anderson and Renee Rogers. And to get to that point, the government, obviously, you can tell in the record, asked Detective Bolt how he got to the point where he was recording conversations of Renee Rogers contacting Dexter Anderson. Those questions and answers of what informant you talked to get to get to that point was offered from my vantage point to explain why all of a sudden we're at the point where we're calling Dexter Anderson and why Detective Bolf knew that number was associated with Dexter Anderson and so on and so forth. I called the five informants or the four or three individuals aside from CI 598, and I'll get to him in a minute, but I called the informants that Detective Bolf mentioned as to how he got to that point where he was doing controlled buys. And they were subject to obvious cross-examination and impeachment for any shortcomings they may have. But it wasn't at all an attempt to give credibility or bolster their testimony, as the defendants are saying. It was to explain why Detective and how Detective both got to that point. And that was an issue in the case. The issue in the case was, one issue that the defense tried to raise was, did Detective Bolth rush to judgment here? Did he pick out the wrong person and target the wrong person? And it was therefore important, at least, not for the truth of the matter, but to indicate how Detective Bolth, why he got to that particular point. Now, if I can get back real quickly to the crack cocaine versus cocaine base issue, I'm looking at Renee Rogers' testimony at page 212. Renee Rogers was asked about the type of crack cocaine she was buying from Dexter Anderson. I asked her the question, let's talk about quality. What was it about the quality of crack cocaine that Dex had that made you contact him? Renee Rogers, the informant, answered, it was more pure than what other people have. Were there other suppliers out there besides Dex in the community that you knew of? Yes, was her answer. Next question, why? What was it about the purity that made Dex's cocaine, crack cocaine, better than others? And here's her answer. A lot of people put too much soda on it or break it down to make it bigger, but it wouldn't really get you high. So just like you're just wasting your money. But Dex's cocaine, crack cocaine, was not like that. No. Did you find it consistently of high quality through your contacts with him? Yeah. I mean, might be one or two times where it wouldn't be, you know, as good, but on most stuff, it was okay. It was okay. Next, I asked about the quantity. What about the quantity of the crack cocaine that Dexter Anderson was selling? Her response, the size, I mean, he gave you what you paid for. He don't try to cheat you. And she's just one of the witnesses. Detective Bolth, first of all, explained by identification the fact that he's seen crack cocaine numerous times. It's in rock-like form at page, I have it for a minute, at page 43 of the transcript. He's talking about the appearance of crack cocaine. He likened it to hardened Play-Doh, only in a tannish form, so on and so forth. That's how he was familiar with crack cocaine. Detective Bolth talked about the cooking process involved in crack cocaine. And besides Detective Bolth and besides Renee Rogers, Mendel Campbell essentially told the jury, I grew up around drugs. I know crack cocaine. That's what I was selling for Dexter Anderson. Lisa Larson, another testifying witness. I ingested the crack cocaine that I was buying from Dexter Anderson and Valencia Parsons. There's no doubt it was crack cocaine. Now, granted, where the confusion, if any, comes in is the fact that there were crime lab reports that showed cocaine base. But that doesn't mean that the substance is something other than that, because we had all these other witnesses identified as crack cocaine. Crack cocaine is obviously a subset of cocaine base. The admission of the crime lab reports confirmed that it's cocaine base and not powder cocaine. But all the other testimony, as far as appearance, as far as use from the informants, all indicate that it's crack cocaine. And then on top of it, the defense doesn't object to type of substance at sentencing. It was agreed, it was stipulated at sentencing that we're speaking of crack cocaine. Throughout this entire case, until obviously the time of this appeal, there wasn't an issue at all as to type of controlled substance. Now, granted, in light of the Edwards case and some of the other cases, the government certainly would have drafted a different stipulation and made it clearer that we're speaking of crack cocaine, but I argue to you that that's not an issue that affects at all the jury's decision in this case. They were properly instructed. You can read the verdict form. I attached it to my supplement. They were properly instructed to return a verdict as to whether the substance was cocaine-based in the form of crack cocaine. And that was an instruction the judge gave as far as weight and type of controlled substance. Crack cocaine base in the form of crack cocaine. It mirrored the indictment that I charged in this particular case. So I contend there just is no issue with respect to the type of controlled substance.
The jury got the standard. The jury got the standard instruction, I assume,
yes,
about
the
counsel's arguments and
yes,
to the extent that there's a conflict between the argument and the evidence, etc.
And I acknowledge that I made misstatements, referenced the stipulation. Obviously, contemporaneous arguments sometimes occur that happen along those ways. They shouldn't. It was a mistake, but it wasn't a material mistake. It wasn't a mistake that went to any issue in this case. It wasn't a mistake that impacted the jury's verdict, given the record in this case, the substantial record of crack cocaine. Now, one other comment reference, CI 598. That's the other significant point that the defense at least tries to allege in this case was of issue. Let me tell you this. It was not. CI 598 was not the bedrock of the government's case. Our case was based on search warrants, controlled buys, and the testifying informants. CI 598 was not the heart of our case at all. The three questions and answers, which you can read in the briefs that I asked both about CI 598, gave nowhere near the type of information that was later relayed through the live testimony of the five informants, bringing everything together. CI 598 offers just a microsecond of what all the other testifying co-defendants or testifying informants and or citizen witnesses indicate in this case. This case was not about CI 598, and there wasn't anything clearly from Bolf's response about CI 598 that impacted the fairness or integrity of this proceeding. The appellants simply can't meet their required standard of review of plain error. In light of all the other overwhelming evidence, as reflected by the trial judge, which got to hear the informants testify, consider the demeanor of the witnesses, including Dexter Anderson, who testified, I just don't believe that they've met their burden of proof in that regard.
Severance?
Pardon?
Severance argument?
I'm sorry.
The severance argument?
The severance issue. Sure. Very simply, for the defense to be able to substantiate that there were antagonistic defenses here that would have warranted severance in this case, they would have to establish that there was no conceivable way that, in this case, Valencia Parsons could have been acquitted or could not have been found guilty, that she didn't stand a chance of being acquitted. That's simply not the case here, and I'll tell you why. In this case, all Dexter Anderson testified to was that Derek had a relationship with Valencia Parsons. He never said Valencia Parsons was out there peddling Derek's dope or a third person's dope. All he said was that Derek had a relationship with Valencia. And that's the same boat that Dexter Anderson was in. Dexter Anderson, if you look at the testimony, acknowledged himself that he had a relationship with Derek. He alleges that it was Derek who was staying with him at his apartment one early November morning when he runs out of the apartment, when police are knocking, in his skivvies, brought back to the apartment, and of course in the apartment, 55 grams of crack cocaine, as identified by Detective Bolf, were found. Valencia is in the same position as Dexter Anderson. So, that being said, easily a jury could, absent of course the overwhelming proof, a jury could, in theory, have come back and said, well, she has a relationship with Derek, so does Dexter Anderson, but she still maintained that it was a third person out there selling the dope. Some Debbie Tate, whatever name was being fostered out there, but they put on testimony that it wasn't me, Valencia, but someone else. I believe the phrase counsel used was someone assumed her identity. So severing the case would have practically resulted in no difference whatsoever. She's in the same boat whether the case is tried with Dexter or not. And Dexter's minimal comments about Valencia just don't arise to the level of anything other than slight finger-pointing, if at all. We would be in a much different situation if Dexter Anderson got up there and said, yeah, Valencia Parsons, she's the one that's selling the dope for Derek Mitchell. But he didn't say that. He merely acknowledged that she had a relationship with him just as he did. And if he's willing to say that and accept that, then hardly she's in a position where there's two prosecutors, as the allegation goes, pointing the finger at her. Hope that answered the question. I don't have any other arguments. I'd rest on my submissions unless the court has further questions for me.
Okay. Carletti.
With 1 minute remaining, I'm going to be very brief and just make a couple of points. First is that our argument does not rely on or require a suggestion of the government having an improper motive in offering Agent Wolf's testimony. There was an unfair impact of this testimony, and that impact was bolstering the hearsay, bolstering and hearsay. Now, the government argues that Wolf's testimony just led the court to where he was in his investigation. This court has warned that allowing agents to narrate their investigations goes far towards abrogating a defendant's Sixth Amendment right, and that's what happened here. Finally, it may be that proper evidence in this case was strong, but the best evidence that the improper evidence in this case mattered and made a difference is that the government offered it, and their own actions in this case created the doubt as to the importance of this evidence in this case.
Okay, thank you. I believe your time expired, Ms. Casey. The case will be taken under advisement. I understand both of you were